So before I begin this evening, I just want to pay some homage and some respect to our ancestors, those who we stand on their shoulders, those who have forged so much ahead of us. I want to honor my mother and my grandmother, and those who have come before me, and all of your ancestors as well. So, I do start every talk with that now, because I realize that this time is what it is for us, and to acknowledge who we are is very important, and where we came from. This evening, I'm going to talk about one of the divine abodes. And it's one that I have come to actually befriend. It's one of those precious Brahma Viharas, one of those precious tools that the Buddha gave us. It's mudita, appreciative joy. Sympathetic joy, and as the Buddha often calls it, altruistic joy. Mudita. You know, it's one of those four qualities that the Buddha said that we need to cultivate in our lives. He describes these Brahma Viharas, metta, karuna, upekkha, and mudita as noble and lofty. It's a great word, lofty. And he also calls them sublime. But what he also encourages us to do is to cultivate and develop these in our lives, because truly they can transform. I didn't quite know how powerful these Brahma Viharas were until I began to actually use them in a long retreat. And I had always been fixated on concentration. I've got to concentrate, right? I'm going to a concentration retreat. And I was told by Joseph Goldstein that these Brahma Viharas can be quite as powerful as any insight and concentration methods if used on a regular basis and then embodied and actually lived. So there is a transformative and concentrated ability in them. But you know, one of the things that I'm so thankful to have learned was that the Buddha said yes. He said yes to love. He said yes to loving all beings equally without discrimination. He said yes to compassion, to all, not just some, but to all. He said yes to rejoicing in the happiness and success of others, not just the ones you like, but everyone. And he said yes to an even-minded steadiness, an ecumenity that helps us face all the vicissitudes of life, all of those eight worldly winds, all the things that try to take us off of our perch and out of our goodness. So I oftentimes think, I remember John Lennon's words, imagine. Just for a moment, if we could say yes to love, if our world said yes to love, yes to compassion. Yes to appreciating somebody else's joy. Yes to the even-minded stillness and knowledge of just knowing. we just take a moment and close our eyes, imagine that. Feel it in your heart. What would our world be like? And what I know is that every step of the wheel, the Dharma wheel that turns, takes us a little bit closer to transforming what is already often our muddled minds. And it takes us into a deep willingness and a strong intention to be consistent about what we're going to cultivate and develop. Because so often what happens, I know for myself, is I forget my true nature. And therefore, I forget the true nature of others. The raw, basic goodness. This is who we are in the world. This is the joy that we that actually can permeate through us. Now, with mudita, this sense of appreciating somebody else's joy. So here's an example, just real quickly. I'm working at a large corporation. I'm not necessarily, but the example. I'm working at a large corporation, and I've been really striving to make that one position. Started at the bottom, and I started my way up. And then somebody came to me who's also been working really, really hard, a coworker, and says, I just got the promotion. It's the one I've always wanted. And in your mind, you're like, good for you. Here's another example. For instance, within hours, hopefully, maybe 24, maybe 48, I'm going to be a grandmother for the first time. Mm-hmm. Feel that? For some, it's like, good for you. So happy for you. I'm happy for your happiness. Look at the juxtaposition of those two examples. And with these divine abodes, and especially with mudita, there's a boundless ability to open our hearts. Was going to read you a story that from the Buddha. A monk had come into his area where he was praying and said, how do I reach these abodes? And he said, you love. You show compassion for the suffering. You are joyous for others' joy. And you have an even equanimous mind. That's how you reach this divine place that will carry you forth to liberation. And it's not so easy. Although, in my examples, there was this moment of, for this impending grandchild that I'm about to have. For me, although the sense of wanting to be joyous for others has been difficult, and there's been a bit of discomfort for me. And in all, I just couldn't quite embody it, because what I kept feeling when almost the first example happened, I felt envy for others sometimes, you know. Or little bit of, wish it was me. So when I came to this discovery last year, I decided I was going to bring all of my attention. This was going to be my practice. So often we take a year of practicing metta. We give ourselves good, saying goodwill for ourselves. We say it for our neighbors. We say it for our benefactors. And then we oftentimes do karuna. Oh, I'm going to be compassionate. But I wanted to actually witness that area in my life with that I was feeling discomfort. So I took, and I would say it's actually a challenge. I took the challenge on. Because what I was finding in myself is I was feeling rather disingenuous towards others. And there were times, of course, not always, but there were times when I was, oh, good for you. Kind of like the old Jay song, you know, smile in your face. You know, but not really. Because it wasn't really what I was feeling. Not always, but sometimes. And I began to look at this as starting the practice last year was, what was the far enemy and the near enemy? And just as a brief overview, the near enemy is a quality that can masquerade itself as the original. But it's not really that. And the far enemy is the absolute opposite. So, for instance, for loving kindness and metta, the near enemy is attachment. The far enemy is hatred. For compassion, the near enemy is pity. The far enemy is cruelty. For mudita, or sympathetic joy, the near enemy is comparison. Hypocrisy, insincerity, joy for others, but it's tinged with this identification of my team or my child. And the far enemy is very clearly envy. And for upekkha, ecumenity, the near enemy is indifference. And the far enemy is anxiety and greed. So going right back to mudita for this appreciative joy, I really was trying to be awake, bring my full awareness to this mental faculty. And what I realized that every time I was starting to see it arise in me, that near or far enemy, the masking of what wasn't really real, I found that I was opening myself up to judgment. And that began to color my thoughts. And more importantly, it started to close my heart. So I paid close attention. And even though these judgments came in multiple forms, they looked a particular way, or they were absolutely right in my face, or they might have been subtle, they were judgments nonetheless. So I started, every time I felt that arise, and you know how that feeling is when something starts to arise within you? You're aware of it. And sometimes we stuff it. But I was aware of it, so I started to ask two questions. One was, what brings me joy? And the other one is, can I be happy for your joy? These were very simple questions. What brings me joy? Can I be happy for your joy? And asking these questions started to transform my heart. As I practiced deeper and deeper every single day, starting to become acutely aware of what was going on, what I recognized was that I recognized the same story over and over again. And what it really came to was it was the story of the baggage that I was carrying. It was the baggage of my own suffering, of my own sense of not belonging. And in essence, I was saying, if I can't be happy, you shouldn't be happy either. Oh, you got that position. It was mine, right? I worked so hard for it. I had a situation just recently where I was talking to a friend, a colleague in the Dharma, and they said that somebody had said, oh, I heard... It's a young teacher, just kind of coming out of a program. I heard John just give a Dharma talk, and God, he was good. And this colleague of mine was like, oh, that's really good. And he later shared with me, that wasn't really what he was feeling. What was arising in him was, well, he's just new. You know, you don't really know how good a teacher could be. All of those eyes, right? All of those, well, if he only heard me. It plays out in a lot of different ways. And yet, we begin to clear, I could at least begin to clearly see how each time my heart closed, I could not stretch and find an expansiveness in my heart to be happy for somebody else's joy. And what I didn't understand was that if I started to harness and gather in that joy, I was actually getting it molten. I was just actually receiving their joy, getting my own. I couldn't see it. So I continued to make this year, this past year, 2016, my year of mudita. And I consistently kept asking my heart to open. Just a little bit more. I wasn't asking for a lot. What I was really asking for was the chatter that was going on in my mind and what I wasn't saying and the sense of my non-belonging to not necessarily cease, but for me to face it. To look at it. And as I began to practice, I went to work and somebody actually told me about their good weekend. And I heard myself say, God, that sounds great. Good for you. And what really happened is that was enough. I stopped with the chatter. I stopped with the kind of smiling in your face but not really meaning it. Because through my practice, through the depth of my practice, I really got that I actually belonged to the fullness of myself. That there was an innate goodness within me, as it was within them and within you. And if I could see you for your true nature, how we came into this world, good, true, and if I could feel that for myself, then I could actually feel this mudita with authenticity and with a genuine sense that I am starting to embody this divine abode. Every step, every breath I take. But I must say that one of the hardest things for me to reconcile has been to look at our world today that is hurting, and as we know, there's so much going on. Politically, emotionally, economically, all those things. And where do I find joy when I look at that? Can I honestly say, ah, oh, yeah, there it is. I was searching. But what it took was me relearning. They say, you know, when you haven't ridden a bicycle, it's easy, just get back on. So I realized that somewhere there had already been this knowledge about where to find goodness. I just needed to relearn it again. Because it was really hard for me to continue to hold on to the pain of what I was seeing in the world, what we see in the world. And here's something that Sharon Salzberg said that I think is very poignant and very necessary right now. One doorway to sympathetic joy is compassion. Life is so fragile, with its volcanic shifts from pleasure to pain, from ease to difficult confrontations, from getting what we want to watching what we just got begin to fade away. We go up and down, all of us. Vulnerability in the face of constant change is what we share, whatever our present condition. If we remember that even people who have more than we do suffer, we will feel closer to them. So sometimes this little green monster that would come up of envy would be because somebody said they got something and I didn't get it. And I just want to digress for a moment and tell you about a trip that my wife and I took many, many years ago to Ghana. It was our first time going to Africa, to the continent. And we were very excited. You know, somewhere within me anyway, I thought, yeah, I'm going to find my roots. There I am. As soon as we got off the plane in Accra, there was hordes of people coming over, asking for money and, Hey, soul sister, let me give some money. And we made it to our hotel. And the next day we went out doing some excursion or whatever, same thing happened. Hey, soul sister, I want, you know, just pulling on us. And then we were driving down the roads and we saw homes made of mud. And cattle and chickens and, you know, families out. And within a day and a half, my wife said, as she hovered onto the bed, she said, I want to go home. This is really hard to see. And I sat with her and I said, let's put on a different lens. Who's to say what we have is the best? They have a family unit that encompasses their children, the parents, the grandparents, and sometimes uncles and aunts and cousins and greats and so forth. In our communities today, we've lost that in our families. We've moved in all these different places. People are trying to live off the land. They're trying to build adobe homes and build straw bale homes and build homes that will sustain them. And as we drove down the road, what did you see? You saw people living off the land. You saw people in mud homes. And did you ever see anyone weeping? There was joy. And once we put on a different lens, it was a different perspective. We could actually feel their joy. Honor their lives after looking at their innate goodness. And that this idea of comparison, well, we're in America. We've got a lot more than you do. We're traveling. We're doing this and that. That began to cease, and we began to look at people for all that they had to offer and found great joy in it. And when they came up to us, instead of almost recoiling back, we just opened ourselves up. You know, Buddhism is often laden with what appears to be just dukkha, dukkha, dukkha. You know? You find it in the Four Noble Truths. Dukkha, dukkha, dukkha. The three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. Dukkha, dukkha, dukkha. The hindrances. So many of the texts. But what I realized in continuing to study the suttas, reading the translation from the Buddha's time, was that the Buddha actually saw moments of enlightenment. Ways in which each step that we take can lead us into this place of joy. It can open the door to transformation and open the door towards, almost an overused word, freedom. At least it's the freedom that I want today. It's the freedom of my mind, of the chatter, the freedom of to be authentic. So as I started to say, this past year, 2016, was quite a year for me. In a lot of ways, things started to unfold, but it was my year of concentrating and giving myself over, almost surrendering to mudita. And there were days when it was really hard. I heard myself wanting to put the brakes on. I don't want to give you this love. I don't want to be happy for you. But once I began to understand that this was actually a portal for me, it became much easier. But not only did I need to do it for myself, but I needed to take it into my workplace, for those I managed. I needed to take it into my sanghas. I needed to take it into my teaching. I needed to take it into my home. I need to relate that way. I began to understand that it's really important for me to define my relationship. Not to the people, but to their innate goodness. I needed to see them with eyes wide open. And more importantly, with my heart open. And I didn't grow up in a time where I had a lot of crust around my heart and I was, you know, I had to survive, that type of thing. That wasn't necessarily my existence as a child. Although it wasn't, you know, peaches and cream, but it wasn't that. So I wondered, where did that come from? The near enemy of mudita, the comparison, the not wanting to give over, just to smile and say, good for you, and mean it. What happened to the filters and the causes and the conditions that wrap us up and render us closed, not just our hearts, but also our minds? So after 1 year of paying attention, all the time paying attention, it was as if I was saying the phrases over and over again. May you be happy in your life. May you find joy in all that you do. May you live a life of ease. Here are some lessons that I learned after this 1 year of deep, deep, concentrated effort. The first was to pay close attention to when my heart was closing and ask for guidance to stay open, my heart and mind, through my mindfulness practices. The second lesson was to breathe first, breathe second, Breathe third. The third lesson was to know my own innate goodness. It helped me to see the fullness and the beauty in others. The fourth lesson was sympathetic joy is actual strength. It's the highest form of joy. The fifth was embodying the divine abodes as part of being of practice, of being of service. One of my greatest desires, honestly, is to be a good steward of the Dharma. And if that is indeed my wish and my desire, then embodying the divine abodes, really embodying it, was paramount. The sixth lesson, that I have the capacity to heal through freeing myself of suffering, therefore helping to heal the suffering of the world. The seventh lesson was breathe first, breathe second, breathe third. The seventh lesson was shifting from judgment to joy. Why, that was hard. The judging mind. The ninth lesson, truly being aligned with my community. That's my family community. That's my Sangha community. That's my work community. That's my neighborhood community. That's this community. Aligning myself truly there. The tenth lesson was breathe first, breathe second, breathe third. The 11th lesson. If I could, I wanted to manifest Martin Luther King's dream of a beloved community, wrapping my arms around. The 12th lesson. Joy and happiness is boundless. Almost makes me want to levitate right now. And you can imagine what my 13th lesson was. Breathe first, breathe second, breathe third. And I know there were more. But this year for me was not just challenging, but the rewards were great, greater than I had ever imagined. I can look out into this audience right now and see the goodness of your joy. Take it in. I can take you in. I can slather you all over me and find that what I get is so much greater than what I give. Mudita. Sympathetic joy. Altruistic joy, as the Buddha says. Appreciative joy. Allowing you to be exactly full, just as you are, without, and actually allowing you to do that without my conditions on you. It's a huge leap. It had been for me. I wanted to read you some lessons, just because I like them. It's called Lessons from Geese. Many of you may have heard this already. As each goose flaps its wings, it creates an uplift for the birds that follow. By flying in a V formation, the whole flock adds 71% greater flying range than if each bird flew alone. Here's the lesson. People who share a common direction and sense of community can get where they're going quicker and easier because they are traveling on the thrust of one another. Here's fact number two. When a goose falls out of formation, it suddenly feels the drag and resistance of flying alone. It quickly moves back into formation to take advantage of the lifting power of the bird immediately in front of it. And here's the lesson. If we have as much sense as a goose, we stay in formation with those headed where we want to go. We are willing to accept their help and give our help to others. Fact number three. When the lead goose tires, it rotates back into formation and another goose flies to the point position. Here's the lesson. It pays to take turns during the hard tasks and sharing leadership. As with geese, people are interdependent on each other's skills, capacities, and unique arrangements of gifts, talents, and resources. Fact number four. The geese flying in formation honk to encourage those up front to keep up their speed. Here's the lesson. We need to make sure our honking is encouraging. In groups where there is encouragement, the production is much greater. The power of encouragement to stand by one's heart or core values and encourage the heart and core of others is the quality of honking we seek. Fact number five. When a goose gets sick, wounded, or shot down, two geese drop out of formation to follow it down to help and protect it. They stay with it until it dies or is able to fly again. Then they launch out with another formation to catch up with the flock. Here's the lesson. If we have as much sense as geese, we will stand by each other in difficult times as well as when we are strong. This is what's called what we need right now. Immense strength. We need honking. We need a formation. We need joy. We need to recognize it in ourselves and we need to recognize it in others. We need to know what our true goodness is, our true selves. Too easy to get swayed. Too easy to let the near and the far enemy approach. For any of the divine abodes. And I'll say my last greatest lesson in this year of mudita was letting go. Letting go to all the preformed things that I had been living with, that I believe served me well. And I have a saying that's on my wall. It says, I'm letting go of you, pain. I'm letting go of you, sorrow. I'm letting go of you, shame and blame. Sorry, I have no room for you in my heart. I'm letting you go. And when you come again, I'll acknowledge you, but will simply say, I've let you go. It's my reminder. Be true to this. Keep my heart open. Watch when it closes. Bear witness to it. Don't walk away. Don't turn your head. Know your innate goodness. The Dalai Lama puts it this way. There are so many people in this world, it simply makes sense to make their happiness a source of our own. Then our chances of experiencing joy are enhanced 6 billion to 1. He says those are great odds. I oftentimes think of mudita as that divine abode that isn't talked about very much, isn't felt very much, because we actually walk around thinking that we're happy for everyone. The practice for me was to be happy with myself, finding my joy. So remember the two questions. How can I have joy for myself? And can I be happy for your joy? Today I can say yes. And today I can say that there is a swirling around me that speaks to light and life and love and joy. And after this past year, it's truly the first time in my life that I can step into the world and feel this way. It's a great practice. And I thank you for your attention. And what we have is we have a few minutes we could do a couple of things. We could do some popcorn style, because I have a guiding question I'd like to ask, or we can divide up into small groups. What would be more comfortable for you? Popcorn?
Popcorn.
Great. So here's an inquiring question I have. Because these are questions I ask myself. You know, I just don't come up with them. I actually ask you the question. I ask myself first. And share only those things that you're comfortable sharing. Speak to an experience when you have realized that you were holding a closed heart towards another. Maybe it was a coworker in that number one example. Maybe it was a friend or family or a Sangha member. And can you recognize if and when your heart opened to mudita? If you could actually remember when your initial reaction was, I'm closed down. My heart is closed. And can you remember the transformation of opening that heart and actually wishing that person goodwill? Speak to an experience when you have realized that you were holding a closed heart for another. And when did you recognize that it could be opened to their joy? So we have a microphone, and we'd love to hear. One of the things for me is that I believe that we're all students and we're all teachers simultaneously at the same time. So I am trusting the wisdom of the Sangha and the teachers in this room, because what you think may be your own experience is probably shared by others. So would anyone like to share?
My experience wasn't so much envy, because it was something that happened for my son, I got an award, and my first experience was I was so proud. I mean, I was like, just so puffed up. I was, oh, this is my kid. And then I saw his face. And he was so happy. And the pride just dropped away. Because it wasn't about me. It wasn't about me. I could see his face. And I could feel the joy he had. And it felt really clean and it felt really good. And it was like that, it was really clear to me at that moment where I wanted my feelings to be.
Wisdom holders, teachers.
I don't have exactly what to ask for, but I definitely had a closed heart with my ex-husband's new wife. And I knew it, and that, I thought that was fine. Well, it was, but then little by little, because I happened to see them at my church, little by little, I just thought that it was, yeah, it just began to open. It just did little by little, and actually, after a couple of years, it's a nice, warm relationship, and it's real. And it's quite miraculous, and yet, it really isn't. It's much easier than having the closed
time. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm open to the business.
So it really didn't serve you, too.
Well, it just was the way it was. I'm sorry. It wasn't like it didn't serve me. It was just, I did that. People expected that. And then I just thought, well, this is stupid. I don't like this.
Yeah.
I don't like the way it feels. So maybe I could, you know, extend a little teeny olive branch here and there and see what happens. And it worked. And it feels way better.
Right.
But I don't think I could have done it any faster.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a matter of time and slowness. Yeah. Anyway.
I mean, that's the cultivation. That's how you develop it in your heart.
I, and it was nice.
Oftentimes I think of taking a chisel when my heart is hardened, and I'm just chipping away. Just chipping away at it until finally it becomes soft and pliable again. And then maybe the world or a condition.
Yeah. Well, my heart wasn't hard to other people.
Yeah, but in this case, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll just say thank you. This is great. I was talking to a friend earlier this week, and she's just turned 80. And I couldn't be with the celebrations. And that made me feel really sad, but and envious. You know, it's like, oh, gee, I wish I could have been there too. Not a mean kind of jealousy thing, but just, you know, But what I noticed, and I've noticed this before, I love the aspect of cultivation and the dark. Even though I felt sad that I had missed out, I really was happy for her that she had been well celebrated. You know, my heart deserves it. Anyway, so it was interesting to notice while I was talking with her that even though I had sort of, you know, the sadness, I really was happy for her. And I was reflecting on this, there's sort of two parts going on. It's sort of the 12-step act as if, which I've been cultivating. And then I realized it's so much easier for me to do that with people I love or like or care about than when I'm not well disposed or when I have felt hurt or somehow slighted. So I'm going to work on that. So thank you.
You're welcome.
So this isn't really about a time when my heart was closed, but a time when it was not fully open and I learned a lot from it. This is about 10 years ago. found out that a friend of mine who does something that is art, I'll just say artistic. He won the Pulitzer Prize.
And well.
So when I got the news, I was overjoyed and was, you know, celebrating, but part of me was also going, wow, I know a guy who won the Pulitzer Prize. Isn't that cool? So it was about 70% genuinely altruistic joy and about 30% selfish joy.
That's a different aspect. That's definitely a different aspect, yeah.
This is kind of current, so it's still unresolved. I don't get what I think I want and need from one of my children, my daughter. I don't get the love and the intimate communication that I feel like I should get. And so my heart has been closed, and I realize that, you know, I want to be happy for her happiness, for whatever it is. But I also, because she's my child, I want to be part of her joy. Mm-hmm. That's the selfish part. I want to be part of her joy. I don't know how else to explain that. And I'm not. Her joy is completely her own. And it has virtually nothing to do with me. But as her parent, I want to be part of it. And I've got to let that go, I think, in order to be open to her joy. I'm not there yet.
Yeah.
Looking at this from the opposite direction in a way. Every once in a while I will hear about someone having some joy, such as yourself, and I feel a spontaneous ah, and I reflect, oh, I'm not so bad after all. I have spontaneous joy for some. You know, it doesn't, you know, sometimes I don't have it, sometimes I don't have it, but it isn't handy. But I find it useful to remember, or when I have it, to be aware of it and be handled.
There it is.
Yes, there is. I am part of this whole thing after all.
Right. The beautiful part is just being able to be a witness to your own experience. It's scary, and yet it is also so beautiful. And let that be the peak experience that you can come back to. So we are at our closing for questions and comments.